All right, chapter 48, 49, and 50. In chapter, I'm not sure how our time will play out, so I'm going to be selective here tonight since we don't have another class to follow up with. We know that Jacob now has arrived in Egypt. He's 130 years old. And he'll be there for 17 more years before he passes away. He's reaching the end of his life here as we get to chapter 48 and 49. And Joseph asked him to bless his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And you recall that generally the oldest received the blessing of the firstborn. The blessing of the firstborn entailed or involved at least two things. One is preeminence, and one is greater blessing, called a double portion. And so when it came time for Jacob to bless Joseph's two sons, they're brought before him here in chapter 48. And you get to verse 13. Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right, and brought them close to him. But Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, crossing his hands, although Manasseh was the firstborn. He blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. And may my name live on in them, in the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." Now, we started way back in chapter 12 with a promise to a man who had no children that God would make of his seed a great nation. That hasn't happened yet. But you still see that promise way back in chapter 12. We're 38 chapters later, over 200 years later. You still see that being referred to here, and that there's going to be a large or populous seed that's going to come from Abraham's seed. Now Joseph saw, verse 17, that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, and it displeased him, and he grasped the father's head to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also will become a people, and he also will be great. However, his younger brother should be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." In Jacob's case, who received the blessing of the firstborn? The younger or the older?
The younger.
The younger, Jacob. So here's time for Jacob to bless his two grandsons. And one might think, well, he's influenced by the fact that he, the younger, got the blessing. But while at this particular juncture in time, you may not know that he's not the reason he gives. That for sure. And there seems to be a confidence in what Jacob is doing. And if he believes that he is indeed in this prophecy, being moved by the Holy Spirit, you can see why I would have confidence in what he's saying. But what's the proof that it wasn't simply a matter of personal preference, that the younger indeed would be the greater of the two?
Because it came true.
What?
Because it came true.
It came true. History. Later on, Isaiah, Ezekiel, other places, you read about two peoples in the land of promise. The southern kingdom is called what?
Judah.
Judah. What's the northern kingdom called?
Israel.
Israel or?
Ephraim.
Ephraim. That tribe became so populous and powerful that the entire northern kingdom was called Ephraim. And so, is it a guess? Is it because of his personal experiences? It came true. And so, if it had not come true, then obviously this would throw discredit on the account here that is being written. So, he blessed Ephraim, saying, he blessed both of them, but Ephraim would become the greater of the two. And so, thus, verse 20, put Ephraim before Manasseh. Verse 22, he said, I'll give you one portion more than your brothers. So each tribe, when they got to the land, got a portion, did they not? Joseph got two. Do you remember the land called Joseph?
No, it wasn't.
Was no land called Joseph. How did he get two? Ephraim and Manasseh. That's right. And so he got two. And so Joseph indeed, and we'll see in this other statement that we read in 49, was very fruitful. But there's a statement at the end of chapter 48. He said, I give you one portion more than your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. There's no record in Genesis where Jacob engaged in a fight with an Amorite as a warrior and took anything from him. There's no record of that. That doesn't mean it didn't happen, but there's no record of it. Secondly, the nature of Jacob, as you've been reading about, is a peaceful man, not a warrior-like man. He's different from his brother Esau. And so that would certainly be out of character with the Jacob that we know. So some, in trying to explain this passage, say that it happened, though it's not recorded, and it's just something that happened, and that parcel of land was given to Joseph. Maybe. But let me suggest an alternative. Look, let me see here in look in John chapter 17. He said, I have glorified you on the earth, having accomplished the work which you have given me to do. Past tense. Had he? No, he had not. There's a figure of speech very common in the Bible. It's called prolepsis, P-R-O-L-E-P-S-I-S, or anticipation. Where what is future is spoken either as present or as past. I wanted this particular example because you've got a number of examples where it's spoken of as present. But here's one where the past is spoken of as if it's actually happened, which it hasn't. It's not a mistake, it's a figure of speech. But what it does is say something about the certainty of it. The future is spoken of as the past, stamping it with certainty. No question it's going to happen. If Genesis 48:22, and I'm not dogmatic about this, but if Genesis 48:22 is that kind of statement, a prolepsis, we have a ready explanation of what Jacob is talking about. Look back at Genesis 15. Genesis chapter 15. And look down at verse 16. Look at verse 16. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not complete. Now down a little bit further, Amorites are mentioned among several other nations in verse 19 following. But here in verse 16, Amorite is put for all of those nations. When a part is put for the whole, what is that? Synecdoche. The wickedness of the Amorite is not full, and they're going to bring judgment on the Amorite, or Amorites, that is, the people in Canaan. And this is not the only place. You get over to Numbers, I believe it was chapter 31, he talks about how they conquered the Amorites. So if that's the case, then what this very well could be, spoken of as past, but it's looking to the future, when indeed, without question, God will give the land to the descendants of Abraham, the descendants of Isaac, the descendants of Jacob. That we know happened. And it was a very improbable thing, wasn't it? How can a bunch of people who've been traveling through a wilderness for all those years conquer cities that were walled with armies? God enabled them to do it. And they conquered them through warfare. And so that's just a suggestion for you to think about, if it's correct. And it may not be. But if it's correct, it shows the value of understanding figures of speech when we run into difficulties sometimes in Scripture. So that's just a suggestion for you to think about that verse.
Steve?
Yes.
Point, when Joshua and people go to take the land, in Joshua 10, it talks about the Amorite kings and how they, you know, capture them and struck them down. All that. So there's a full story about Joshua fighting the Amorites.
Yes, there is. As Linda said, there's Joshua in the book of Joshua covers the actual battles with them, as well as the book of Numbers talks about it as well. All right, let's go to chapter 49 now of our reading.
I don't think that's correct. I just think it's interesting.
Some will make it refer to that, but Jacob condemned that. It'd be hard to think that he's now blessing it as a promise. Yes. And Jacob did not approve of what they did. So, yes, you're right, Lisa. Some will make that refer to that. And that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. What does that tell you about your references? Be careful. Be careful about your references. So I'm glad you brought that up. Okay, we're in chapter 49. Now, I don't know how many of you have, I think some of you in this audience have been around long enough to hear preachers talk about the last days. When you read about the last days in the Bible, you may have heard preachers say that refers to what? All right, some say the end of the world. Okay, that's often what it's made to mean, is the last dispensation. Heard that since I was a boy growing up here preaching the last days. And whether it ever refers to that is not our point tonight. Our point tonight is simply this. Every time you see that phrase, you can't interpret it in the light of what you've heard Church of Christ preachers say. you interpret it in the light of context and harmony. So in this particular version, in the New American Standard, it says in the days to come, but it's translated last days in the King James and New King James Version. I'm not arguing about the translation. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying, what does it mean? That's the question. The American Standard translates it the latter days. And I'll make mention of another idea in just a moment. But those are some of the major translations. Now, the reason I feel very certain that last days here is not talking about the Christian dispensation is this. As you start in verse 3 and you start talking about the 12 boys, the blessings, or the curses, many of these events took place in the centuries before the Christian dispensation. For example, you have Reuben in verse 4. He said, you will not have the preeminence. You will not have the preeminence. That's not in the Christian dispensation. That happened in the centuries before that Reuben lost his preeminence. Preeminence is one of the rights of the firstborn. And then you'll read also about Simeon and Levi, that it says that they would be scattered or dispersed in Jacob and scattered in Israel, verse 7. Of course, the Levites got no land. They had cities. And the descendants of Simeon had maybe 13 cities, but they never were the tribes the others were. Finally, were just assimilated in Judah, seems like. But that's all previous to the Christian dispensation. Are we saying there's nothing in chapter 49 about the Christian dispensation? I am not saying that. I'm saying don't let yourself be trapped into hearing last days. Oh, that's the Christian dispensation. Reading it in Genesis 49 and immediately making that kind of an interpretation. Read the context and see what he's talking about in the context. One translation, it's an individual translation, but by Mr. Barnes, he says, in the after days. The word just means days to come. That little phrase, two words, means days to come. But then he makes this comment, which I think is excellent. The after days are the times intervening between the speaker and the end of the human race. That's what he has in mind. Between now and the end, here are some things that are going to transpire. He's going to say some things about the Messianic age when we get down to Judah. But I don't know what he means by the days after this unless I read something in the context. Okay. So we have Jacob, this patriarch, issuing his final blessing. This is not the only case in the Bible where a patriarch issues his final blessing. Of course, we saw Isaac doing it with his boys, Genesis 27. We're in Moses, Deuteronomy 33, had a blessing for the nation. Joshua had a blessing on the people. It was more of a challenge before he died, but this was not uncommon with these patriarchs before they died. All right, so we come down here to Reuben. Let's start with Reuben. We'll not comment on each one of these in any depth at all. One, there's sometimes very little said. And two, I know of no way to be certain as to what Jacob meant. But be that as it may, there are some very valuable lessons here. We start with the oldest one, Reuben. Reuben, you are my firstborn. So he was the first boy born to Jacob. And he says, he was uncontrolled as water, and you shall not have the preeminence. Because you went up to your father's bed, did you defile it? He went up to my couch. So here's Reuben. He was unable to control his passion and his desires. You know, it's interesting to me. I've had men who are supposed to be Christians sit in my house and talk about their desires are stronger than other men, and they're just so hard to control. And that's shameful. Anybody can control their desires, whether it's sexual desire, desire for drugs, desire for alcohol, anger, whatever it may be. But what's interesting is this is not approved. Now, if our calculations are right on Reuben here, he's about 63 years old. And the event that Jacob is talking about happened 39 years earlier. 39 years. Sometimes we think, well, time will fade everything away. Not necessarily. Sometimes we pay for the deeds that we have done earlier in our life in later years. That's exactly what happened to Reuben. So here he is 39 years later at the age of 63, and he has this withdrawing of the blessings of the firstborn. Was Reuben sorry he had done that? Maybe. But you can't undo history. You can't back up and rewind the tape. So what a lesson for us today. And Jacob did not approve of his conduct in sleeping with his father's wife. So the leadership, as we'll see in a moment, went to Judah. He's the one, instead of Reuben having the leadership, which he should have as the firstborn, that became Judah's right. And the double portion went to Joseph. We saw that in 48:22, and then Deuteronomy 21 and 1 Chronicles 5, which we'll not read. And so those two aspects of being the firstborn was lost to Reuben, even though they should have been his. Any comments about Reuben before we move to Simeon and Levi? All right, Simeon and Levi are noted for what? For Shechem. What happened at Shechem? Where they went in and deceived the men into being circumcised before they could marry Dinah. And then, of course, they went in and killed them, took their animals and their property. And so, verse 5, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their counsel. In other words, I had no part in this scheme. I'm not approving of it. I have no share in it, what they did. Let not my glory be united with their assembly, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. You're not into your Bible, but into chapter 4, where you see this business of anger against somebody leading to murder. Lamech talked about killing a man for wounding him. And anger can drive us to do things that are ungodly that we may pay for years later. And Simeon and Levi pay for their anger years later. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Now, when you get to the census later on, in the first census, at the first part of Numbers, Simeon was actually 59,300. The second census, 38 years later, is 22,200. And then they were only allotted 13 cities and some surrounding village in the inheritance of Judah. Book of Deuteronomy doesn't mention them at all. And apparently they weren't able to sustain their strength of numbers. And later you almost find them, like Judah, just kind of assimilated them into Judah. They're spoken of with Judah. And so here's a consequence of their anger. Levi. It's interesting about Levi, because he too was dispersed because he had no land. He got cities. But, so here's Jacob writing this at this particular juncture. But if you go to Deuteronomy chapter 33, and verse 8, now Moses is writing all of this, but what he's writing here in Genesis 49 predates what he's writing over here by what? 400 or 500 years. Say 400 at least. And he says in verse 8, of Levi he said, remember I said here's Moses' patriarchal blessing and he talks about the various tribes. But here he says of Levi, he said, let your Thummim and your Urim belong to your godly man whom you proved at Massah, with whom you contended at the waters of Meribah, who said of his father and his brother, I did not consider them, did not acknowledge his brothers, nor did he regard his own sons, for they observed your word and kept your covenant. They shall teach your ordinances to Jacob and your law to Israel. They shall put incense before you and hold burnt offerings in your altar. So their zeal for the Lord, even over family, grants them a blessing. And what that says is something about the fact of the genuineness of this writing, Genesis 49. Because Moses wrote this years later, but if he had fabricated it, you would think that would be reflected over here in Genesis 49. It's not. When Jacob talked about Levi, it was not favorable. But something else transpired in history by the time he wrote Deuteronomy 33 that caused God to give them a special blessing. Okay. Now let's look at Genesis 49 beginning in verse 8. Verse 8 through verse 12 is maybe the most significant of the three chapters that we're looking at tonight. This is about Judah. So let's start at 8. Judah, your brother, shall praise you. Skip the next line and go to the third one. Your father's son shall bow down to you. The middle line tells you why they're going to praise you and bow down to you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies because, in other words, of your conquest, of your rule. It's the idea. And they'll willingly submit to you is the idea. The next line is Judah is a lion's whelp. Skip the next two lines and go to the next line. And as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The middle two lines say, from the prey, my son, you've gone up. He couches, he lies down like a lion. Those are merely commenting on the idea of a young lion. But you have, he's a lion's whelp. Who dares rouse him up? It's the idea. Then you have this verse 8. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. Now, what is the scepter? Now, scepter was sometimes just a staff. But sometimes it was more than that. And the next line tells you that it is in this particular case. Nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Rulers would lay the staff between them, toward them, and it was a symbol of rule, of reign, of authority. And so the scepter in this particular case is the idea of rule or dominion. And he says it will not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. Shiloh, what in the world is Shiloh? Well, we'll talk about that in just a moment. But note the next line, to him should be the obedience of the peoples. Note the S on peoples. He ties his colt, his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine. The next line goes under that, and his robes are the blood of grapes. This is one of the passages, kind of a side point, by the way. Does wine here refer to fermented wine or distilled wine or wine that's been mixed? What does wine mean if you let the next line explain it? Fresh, squeezed grapes. So people say, other word, wine always means something fermented, intoxicated, or mixed, or distilled, or no, it's fresh squeezed grape juice here. This passage. And then his eyes are dull from wine, his teeth white from milk. Or, and you have a footnote, if you have a, like the New American Standard on that, suggesting the, instead of dull from wine, they're bright. And the same thing with the teeth, which either indicates the healthy countenance due to the abundant crops and harvest, or possibly the appearance of Judah. But it's a blessing throughout. Now, let's go back and look at... he says, back up, he says, your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Who did David come through?
Judah.
David conquered his enemies? Yes, he did. Did the people willingly submit to David eventually? Yes, they did. The other tribes. For a while there was a divided kingdom, but then it was a united kingdom, as you recall. And Christ, of course, conquered all his enemies. I have a number of verses here, but we'll not have time to look at all of those. It's interesting here that he said, verse 8, your father's son shall bow down to you. Your father's sons. If it had said mother's sons, how many of the boys would have included? See, they had different mothers. Father's sons gets the whole nation. Your father's sons will bow down to you. And that's what he's saying, is that Judah would have ultimate reign. Now, look at this term Shiloh for just a moment. We're not certain about, or at least I'm not, the meaning of Shiloh. I looked and researched it, but I can't be certain about its meaning. But one possibility is that it has to do with peace, a man of rest. And so he says, your scepter will not depart until Shiloh comes. Not till the beginning point of that, but until the climax of Shiloh coming. That is the climax of his reign. Now, does this refer to Shiloh? You're not going to remember all of this. If you want the notes, I can send them to you. But here's some reasons I believe that it does refer to the Messiah. First of all, it agrees with the meaning of the term Shiloh as a peaceful ruler. That is the nature of the Messiah's rule. Secondly, it agrees with the fact that the Messiah came from Judah. Third, it agrees with similar prophecies about the Messiah. We don't have time to read them in Numbers, Isaiah, so forth. And fourthly, Solomon wrote a prophetic song about the Messiah, and it was the idea of a peaceful king. So all of that favors the idea that until Shiloh come, points to the Messiah, the reign of the Messiah, who did indeed come through Judah. So if that's the case, this is a messianic prophecy. We've already observed back in chapter 48 this statement about the abundance of the peoples. That was back in chapter 12. Where's the first time you read about a messianic prophecy in Genesis?
Three.
Chapter 3. And it's been referred to in chapter after chapter, 12 and 15 and 17 and 22 and so forth. So here you are at the beginning of the book. The seed of the woman will conquer Satan. Here at the end of the book, you have a prophecy about Judah, about one who would reign and conquer all his enemies, and people would bow down to him and serve him, and looking to the Messiah. So does the Genesis, book of Genesis have some threads that run through it, that give it a unifying form? Yes, it does. So we've been looking at that as we went through the book, and this is in perfect accord with that idea. Now, some of these others, names here, we've got Zebulun, Issachar, Dan, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, some things said about them, but can't be certain about all of that. If we had time, we could talk about it, but we're going to skip through all of that. I just mentioned something here about Joseph. Verse 22 following. Seems to be a prophetic song of praise for Joseph. There's an interesting statement in this about Joseph in verse 22 through 26. Note, he says, Joseph is a fruitful bough, a fruitful bough by a spring. Its branches run over a wall. The archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him. But his bow remained firm and his arms were agile. From the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. From the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you with blessings from above. So it's imagery of war that was waged against Joseph, but he overcame. By whose help? The shepherd of Israel. Isn't that what we've been reading from chapter 37 on? He was sold by his brothers. He was put in prison by Potiphar. He was forgotten by the man who interpreted his dream. Just one thing after another, one thing after another. But you see the providence of God all through it. Now Joseph is the ruler of Egypt. He's got his two boys. He's been blessed by Jacob. Ephraim becomes the northern kingdom. Indeed, he's been fruitful in spite of all of the efforts of his enemies to attack him and bring him down. And if God is our helper, the same can be true with us. And so it's a beautiful song of praise about the fruitfulness of Joseph. So these are the 12 tribes, verse 28. And then verse 33, Jacob dies. So chapter 50, we've got just a few minutes here, chapter 50. So they embalmed Israel, verse 2. Now, 40 days were required for it, for such is the period for embalming. The Egyptians wept for him 70 days. The days of mourning for him were past. Joseph, as you know, requested of Pharaoh to be able to fulfill the promise that he made to his dad to bury him back in the promised land. And he was granted that privilege. So, you have the procession back to bury Jacob. When you get down to verse 15, however, interesting thing. Now dad's out of the picture. When Joseph's brothers saw their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him?" They sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father charged before he died. Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brother and their sin, for they did you wrong. Now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. They appealed to daddy, his love for daddy. And obviously that moved Joseph. But was that necessary for Joseph?
No.
No. Joseph feared God. And you see that a little later here. And so, verse 19. When I read this, I think, how far was Joseph ahead of his time? hold your finger right here and go to Romans chapter 12. We'll move all the way to the time of the New Testament. And Romans 12 is talking about how Christians interact. And you can be mistreated by people who claim to be Christians. He deals with that in this chapter. But look at verse 19. "Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God, for it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink, for in so doing you'll heap burning coals of fire on his head." Don't seek your own revenge. Does that mean God's not going to avenge you? No, it doesn't mean that. It's just not your department. That's God's department. The souls under the altar in Revelation 6 are crying for vengeance, but it's not their department. That's God's department. Look at this statement here in Genesis 50. Joseph said, verse 19, "Do not be afraid, am I in God's place? That's not my department. Render vengeance." Isn't that interesting? It's not my job to exercise revenge against you. "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive." And he could see the hand of God in it, in spite of the fact he was mistreated. What a wonderful attitude. And so I have the privilege to talk to Brandon, who's in prison, and he's often mistreated by those who are the guards. But never have I detected, at least at this point, any feelings of bitterness or revenge. He said, "I just pray for him." And I appreciate so much that attitude. So verse 22, Joseph stayed in Egypt and he lived 110 years. Got to see the third generation of Ephraim's sons, verse 23. Verse 24, what does that imply about Joseph, that request?
He believed
in the promise. Faith. Bring my bones back there. Joseph was a man of faith from the time he was a young boy. And we see it now at 110 years old. So what would that be? 83 years? And here he is through all his life continuing to believe in God. What a great example for us. Okay, my time is up. Thank you so much for all your comments through the class. Hope that the class was of some benefit and value. And so of some interest. Lord willing, we'll begin with denominationalism on Sunday. You can pick up the lessons there in the back. Thank you again.